right, we are back with episode 523 of the Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I heard the funnest term this week. It was called math magicians.
And I've been told by Control that I'm allowed to discuss these things with you guys today. So hopefully our representative from Samaritan will continue to allow it as well. But before we get any further into this, Edmund, why don't you go ahead and give us that thing we call a disclaimer.
Absolutely. The things we discuss might get you into real trouble with some authorities because we're going to spoil the heck out of every episode we discuss. So you will just have to take it up with Samaritan, and that's why we've given you a week or so to get ready for that.
Yes, and remember, hiding out with someone like Root, not the worst thing in the world. Anyway, we are going to be going over the episodic discussion this time. Yes, we had an entire episode of news, which is very rare for us. But quite frankly, once we get through this episode of discussion, you're going to realize why there wasn't a whole lot that was on the air. And, well, some of the stuff was a show that only one of us maybe watches or none of us watch and is just reviewed by some of our friends in the wider Critical Myth authorship. So, yeah, it's a little bit of a slow week. And so, actually, this will be the end of the week for us. We will not have a third show this time around. But we will be back, oh, will we ever, next week. There is a ton coming out. And we're actually looking forward to that. But before we get into the discussion, Gary, you had some other topics that you wanted to cover.
Yeah, I did. I wanted to mention something that about, I guess, Marvel and or Disney, although I'll keep it at the Marvel discussion level. Recently in the comic books, they have killed off Wolverine. This, at the surface, at face value, might seem like a sort of a running joke that, they killed the comic book character. He's never, you know, they're never dead for long. But it's been proposed by several people, and I've taken up this theory a little bit that Marvel is attempting to somehow kill off or stifle any comic book property that they do not own the movie rights to. We've already seen them take a award-winning run of the Fantastic Four and run it into the ground as far as sales goes, and without making any real attempt to change writers or artists the way that they typically would on the comic. Now there's Wolverine that's killed off, so that won't potentially spin any new material for movies for him. Then I've also heard rumors that they're thinking of sort of shuffling Peter Parker off to the side again and promote the more Ultimates comic version of him, who is a Hispanic boy. As a result, this would change the character significantly enough that some lawyers feel it would break the terms of Sony's agreement over Spider-Man. As a result, now they've denied three major franchises to other movie studios, with no real care about the characters, the audience, or the fans. And it just strikes me as, I guess, greedy, or it's just, I'm surprised they would be willing to damage these products in such a way and dimension to make them unsaleable as a movie for that sole reason, just so that someone else can't do a movie with them. What's your thoughts on something like this? It's almost like a scorched earth policy, for lack of a better term.
Well, I definitely see that happening with Fantastic Four, and I think that it's maybe a bit of a reaction to not only the studio who owns the rights to it basically doing whatever it takes to maintain the rights or the license, but just the direction that they're going is just so unpalatable to so many people. And yet they still have announced at least a release date for the sequel, which seems a bit presumptive to me. When it comes to the Wolverine thing, I'm way behind on my reading, but I'm still very much aware of that going on because, of course, it's been widely reported. What maybe isn't as obvious is that it is a massive, massive event. I mean, there are like a ton of spin-off series about, you know, what it reminds me more of, actually, is the huge event that the death of Superman was, where everyone knew it wasn't going to stick, but it was more the question of what are they going to do in the meantime and how are they going to deal with the fallout. In fact, I think there is a spinoff called Wolverines.
Yes, it is. And you see everyone from, I think, Sabretooth to I think even Mystique dressed in Wolverine's brown costume, yes.
So, I mean, like I said, I haven't actually gotten to around to reading all that yet, but I am aware of it, and I'm thinking that it's more of a they're going in a certain direction with their universe, and there's a and actually what the alternative explanation might be is that they're looking for or they're setting the stage for a not maybe a New 52 level reboot, but a reshuffling of properties on a not dissimilar level, shall we say? Because I fully expect Wolverine to come back, and I expect it to happen roughly around the time that Wolverine 2 comes out. Because I think that the relationship between Fox and Marvel slash Disney is much better. Again, the care of the property has been somewhat better in recent years. As far as the Spider-Man thing is going, I had heard that actually they are much closer to an agreement to bring Peter Parker into Infinity War, at the very least. So maybe there's some conflicting information there.
Yeah, I had heard that he was back out again, so.
Maybe, but I don't know that bringing Miles Morales into it is a necessarily bad idea. It might be a very elegant solution to allow both to exist simultaneously. I think the problem is more that is Sony really trying to convince us that they can maintain a Spider-Man franchise at all at this point? I think it's a incomplete disarray. I mean, Andrew Garfield has been reported as being fired or let go, and yet simultaneously being told that he's still there and prepping for eventually playing Peter Parker again in Amazing Spider-Man 3, which was also reported as potentially being off the radar again. It's all over the map from Sony's side. And so I almost feel like Marvel and or Disney would be in the perfect position to kind of throw their weight around a little bit there. If they decided to kind of go down this other direction and go with Morales, or even maybe, they've done a lot of expansion on the Spider-Man concept recently as well, and a couple very popular variations on the theme. I think they've did some kind of alternate universe stuff going on, and they have a Gwen Stacy as Spider Girl or Spider Woman or whatever. Again, I don't know the names because I'm not up on it quite yet. I'm just aware of it because I see the art everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think there's a Silk is another one of these that has been extremely popular and has her own at least miniseries, if not a book. And there's just other ways that they can do this that would still be quote unquote in universe and at least have the spirit of the of that side of Marvel in it. So maybe I'm taking a slightly more positive look at it. I do agree that Fantastic Four, did they start the process early by killing off the book as a putative measure or a punitive measure rather? I'm fairly sure they did. I think they've even kind of all but said it. Whether or not that gave them the idea, hey, let's really shake things up, because they're kind of ending Hickman's run on all these Avengers books and restarting the a new story arc, and it's all wrapped into this big thing going on that they've, they're from what I understand, they're revisiting a lot of the big storylines and alternate universes that they've done, like Age of Apocalypse. They're kind of revisiting House of M, Secret Wars. There's a lot of stuff that they're revisiting, and it feels almost like they're capitalizing on what the MCU is doing at the same time, maybe refreshing some things. And like I said, it feels like a sea change, but how pervasive it's going to be, I don't know. And so I don't know that we can draw conclusions until we see where they really go with things. But I don't know that all three of those examples are following suit with the Marvel playing scorched earth. If they were, I would almost be certain that Disney had some part in that. Because Disney and copyright protection. Poison the well, scorch the earth, take it and then hang on to it forever.
It just surprises me that they would go to any length to, damage a property, an intellectual property.
It is unusual, and I really hope that the Fantastic Four thing is just kind of, again, just a playing on maybe people's assumptions and maybe a very odd way of generating buzz for like, oh, what are they going to do now? Or with it, Are they really going to kill it off? I mean, we know they're going to have to bring it back eventually because it is one of the foundational type of things for the for Marvel Comics, but will it be after the movie has tanked? I mean, that's a presumption. We don't know. The movie could be popular. Then what do you do? Now, granted, I'm saying that even knowing that something like Amazing Spider-Man 2, which made money, was panned by a lot of fans. So a bad adaptation may make money and still be considered, a failure. But we'll see. We'll see. I do find it an interesting way of looking at it. And again, maybe if I was up to date with reading the material, I'd have a different opinion of it. But just looking at the kind of digital stack that I have right now, it's hard for me to really draw one conclusion from everything.
Yeah, I would
Oh, no, I got you. Okay.
just say, as the more casual fan who does not keep up with the books the way you two do, just on the face of it, I mean, I certainly understand the machinations, and as John said, I mean, that Marvel has pretty much admitted to the sort of punitive nature of what they're doing with the Fantastic Four, but also just as a strictly as in knowing the books as I do, if anything, Fantastic Four being one of those, I mean, truly original Stan Lee creations is also the one that's kind of showing its age in terms of this group with this strong scientist patriarch leading these four. It's the one that was probably the most due for an update. So even if in that case they are doing it for copyright reasons and trying to get their hands back onto it, I think that's the one case where having a little shake up and trying to update and modernize it could actually make quite a bit of sense.
I will say that at least in my opinion, and I mean others certainly may have a different view on this, since the end of Hickman's run on Fantastic Four, I just haven't been feeling it. What I have read has just felt very derivative and really not going anywhere. That's kind of the problem with the way that the properties are being run in general, is that you get writers on a certain subset. Whether it be Marvel, and you have people writing, like I said, Hickman's writing Avengers right now, and he's kind of running the show with the Avengers side of things, just like Bendis did for many years. He's got his grand vision of what's going on. Remender does this as well. There's a whole slew of books in Marvel that are all basically continuing this grand storyline he started years ago, and it's its own little sub-universe where, yes, there is reference to other stuff, but it's kind of almost creator-owned in its own fashion. But DC's doing that too with Snyder and all of his stuff with Batman. But you can the problem is then is that you get a creative team on something relaunching it with usual as usual a new number one, which then eventually reverts back to old numbering sooner or later. But whatever you might say, if that team doesn't really work out, then it just feels like you're treading water. And unfortunately, whether it feeds into this conclusion about the Fantastic Four, the current run just is not doing much for me, and it may feel intentional because it's such a drop from the quality that Hickman was bringing to it, but I don't know. I almost feel like they needed to end it to complete the run with this creative team and just move on to something else. But we shall see. It's if nothing else, what still surprises me is that, and maybe it's just the way that the business works now, it feels like there's more out on the shelves than there has ever been since like the height of the 90s. And it's almost like they have to maybe survive by volume versus having just a few. I feel like they need to get back to what Marvel did during its bankruptcy years almost and winnow down the titles to something a little more manageable and focus on just the highest quality material they can put out on maybe, a couple dozen titles versus several dozen titles. But I don't know the state of the business right now. So,
Well,
there's a reason why DC has 50 plus books every month. So.
if you take the printing out of it, though, as far as digital goes, I mean, all things said and done, artists and writers get paid, a few $100 a page even between them. So, one book, say what's a current book now? 40 pages is not a significant amount of money that, they could probably turn around and see it back easy. So maybe there is a benefit to that, but. I mean, people who think comic book writers and artists are making fortunes are way off. I mean,
No, there's a reason they do multiple books a month. It's just that's the only way they can survive.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, costs to put out a book are not crazily is not a hurdle. I have to imagine, much like it was with CDs, it's the physical production of the book that, you know, drives up costs on them. So, you know, maybe they could do a lot more if they, you know, push the digital model more, as they're doing in some cases. There are some direct to digital books, or at least digital first books. So, you know, we'll have to see. But I don't think less necessarily is the answer, but I think cheaper ways to do it, like digital only, might be.
Yeah, I mean, whatever can help them, because certainly, like you said, it's right now you might have a 40-page book. I know that the because a lot of the digital versions don't have the advertising, because it's not worth it in many cases. It's down to like anywhere between 18 to 22 pages of material. And I remember when, I mean, it used to be closer to 30, easy, back when I started reading. So, I mean, we've definitely seen that they need to up the advertising in the printed version. It's not unlike the, you know, TV. The standard episode used to be 25 to 28 minutes for, or not 20, excuse me. If it was a half hour, it would be, yeah, around 25 to 28 minutes of that half hour. Now it's down to 18 to 20. So you see a significant drop in the amount of actual content, to the point where we now have, you know, title sequences that are just a flash of a title card, because literally that's the only way they can regain that minute and a half that they need for story, because, you know, how you either give up your title sequence and give that to the advertisers for extra time, or you are cutting out story. So, yeah. We're going to go ahead and take our break here. It's a good point. And then we'll be back with the episodic discussion, so stay tuned. Yes, it's time for us to turn away from the comic book universe, more or less, and get back into our TV episodic discussion. And as usual, we are going to start off with what is the best show of the week, the highest scored out of all of us, the collective Critical Myth group. There were actually only six shows.
That's our lowest ever.
Six shows. So we're only really going with one at the top and one at the bottom. But the top show is a repeat champion this week, and it is Person of Interest. So here is the promo.
Next Tuesday.
Are you ready for this?
Let's go get Shaw back.
Where is Shaw? Where is she?
You think she's dead?
I know she's alive, Harold.
The Person of Interest.
All right, and Edmund, if you don't mind doing the recap.
Absolutely. This is Person of Interest, Season 4, Episode 12, Control-Alt-Delete. Control, who oversees the handling of relevant numbers for the government, begins to question the methods and intentions of the Samaritan program. Meanwhile, alarming reports of a pair of vigilantes rampaging through the Northeast begin to surface.
And this episode got a collective score of 9. That's a little bit of a drop from the last episode, and quite frankly, a little bit of a surprise. I was, based on last year, we know that the end of the trilogy was really on a high note. This time, I almost feel like the trilogy ended on, well, not even an ending. It's kind of like the trilogy is continuing right into the next episode.
Well, certainly, I mean, the big difference this year was taking that hard left turn back into the other side of the machine and into the relevant side and actually getting to see how this new regime under Samaritan is working from Control's point of view and certainly giving the opening half of your episode over to Cameron Manheim isn't necessarily a bad thing but it certainly was a remarkable shift but to a certain extent I mean certainly given the focus on Shaw coming out of that middle episode and her fate, shall we say, since it is a little up in the air. It did make a certain amount of sense, since of course the relevance episode that she was introduced was our first introduction to the whole government side of things. But you're right in terms of especially the way they kept trumpeting it this season far more than they did last year. As the person of interest trilogy, it was almost more just recalibrating things and showing us her side of the conflict against the Samaritan, and if anything, just I shouldn't say just because it was all rather interesting, but giving us both sides of the story as they continued in into the rest of the season, and how each side is going to try chipping away at Samaritan's new hegemony, there is one thing I did kind of like that whole thing about the pair of vigilantes, even though, yes, we really were kind of expecting it to be recent route. I thought they did a very good job of making it a little bit uncertain, given what we've already seen about Samaritan's own horde of operatives. Certainly when they were specifically going after Control and taking her out before she could get the last terrorist, in fact, it was recent route, just trying to find out what the fate of Shaw was, rather than Samaritan protecting itself. What were your thoughts on all of this shift in focus?
I feel like it made sense, or it would have made sense, I think, if you wound up with Control turning around and suddenly being a little more sympathetic to Team Machine. But the fact that really this was showing Control being almost still in the middle, just more aware of being in the middle and more more quote unquote in control of being in the middle, it felt like incremental change, and all it did was really open up the question of, is Shaw alive? There's a part of me that feels like it would be interesting if her death was faked to some degree, that, obviously she was wounded, but then Samaritan's agents are somewhere just debriefing the hell out of her. At the same time, I feel like there would be something somewhat poetic to just them being on a journey to recover her. And that might be more in keeping with the level of danger that Samaritan represents. I think the problem that they are giving us right here, and to be honest, I really expected this episode to end with them recovering Shaw's body.
Yeah.
They run the risk of having increased the stakes, yet not paying it off. If HR was able to be handled, yet there was the casualty with Carter, the fight against Samaritan has got to have at least a similar level of consequence. And I really am, there's a lot of consequence in terms of random people, but I'm not feeling or seeing the same level of consequence to the team. And that's where Shaw's apparent death was a good punch to the gut. But now I'm feeling like, please don't step back from that. Make it worthwhile. But I do feel like that the team needs that sense of closure because, you know, Reese needed the closure when it came to Carter's death. Right now, Root and Reese would need that closure when it comes to Shaw's fate. And it would be far more interesting to see what they discover in trying to recover Shaw and what path that puts them on. If I wanted to kind of hazard a guess, as much as I hate the fact that this is happening to the two prominent female characters and it once again happening to the female character, despite the fact that they are awesome characters in general, I could see this becoming Root's kind of the either her moment of epiphany for losing Shaw, even though never really had her in the first place, or really feeding into her nihilistic side, and this being kind of, you know, the last thing that Finch and Reese need is for Root to go off the rails, and she's already on the brink now. So there are so many interesting ways that they would go with this. I really would hate it if it wound up that Shaw is dead and then Root basically goes down a path of self-destruction, because I don't want to lose either of them, really, but they're going to lose somebody. And, you know, you got to know that Fusco's on the sidelines going like, yeah, I'm like, you know, I was in the lurch last year and got out of it at Carter's expense.
Yeah.
But
might be his turn.
It might be.
I mean, one thing that I wonder about is, and this is one case where, you know, as I've said, I avoid previews now, but in the aftermath of last week's episode, you know, it was impossible to avoid the behind-the-scenes stuff. And I really do wonder this whole thing of this happening as much because of Sarah Chahi's pregnancy and then discovering she was not only pregnant but pregnant with twins. And I do wonder if there is some, what we're seeing here is some of the ambivalence on the part of the writing staff of where, you know, yes, she's probably, you know, she definitely needs to be away from the show, but I think they're having a hard time letting go. And certainly there were the little hints that were coming through in terms of Shaw being sort of sympathetic with Samaritan's approach, and whether, you know, which to my mind was bringing up this possibility of could somebody be turned? I mean, Greer went after Root last season, which we knew wasn't going to work because of her relationship with the machine. But if Shaw is, you know, that Shaw is certainly the one character who could possibly be turned or turned into a double or triple agent. I think maybe the writers were thinking along those lines, but then got faced with this prospect that, you know, yes, she not only has to be away, but she's going to have to be away for a while. So I agree with you. I think I would prefer for it to be a definite break, but I've got a horrible feeling that they're going to keep it more up in the air.
I actually, knowing that, feel like that presents a far more interesting spin. You could have her away for a while and then come back as, you know, think about it, right? She left things off with Root pretty well. And Root would be operating on this, you know, I've got to find Shaw, and they could have evidence that she's still alive and just be trying to hunt that down as they're dealing with Samaritan, only for her to come back as an agent for Samaritan. Not only does that resolve my fear about the awesome female cast members kind of getting whittled down, but it actually puts the focus on them and the betrayal aspect of this. Because it wouldn't just be a betrayal of Root, it would be a betrayal of Root's God, really.
Yeah,
which would be a really interesting way to go. What I find so amazing about that prospect is that it doubles down on something that I felt for quite some time, which is Person of Interest went from being the show of reach of Finch and Reese and has become all really about the female characters. And they've made this switch and it felt so natural. And I feel like right now Finch and Reese are more, at least on equal footing or in a support role to Root from the machine's point of view, which is a really interesting way to go. It's playing with the convention, and that's why I'm kind of like now going, that may not be a bad way for them to resolve it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a much better way of doing things than, say, the way Chris Carter handled Julian Anderson's pregnancy.
Right.
And never really quite did it fully. Here it might work out better in the long run if Shahi needs to be away for a while to play with that. I still feel like there has to be a consequence sooner or later. They toyed with the idea of Elias being a victim of the war. I don't know that that's not just foreshadowing at this point either, but that is a spin or take on it that I had not considered, and I'm actually hoping that you're right.
The other thing I wanted to comment on, I mean, as far as Control goes, I liked the way they planted the seeds of doubt but did not have her come around yet, because she is so committed to her side of the job, and certainly all those exchanges with the chief of staff of how many she's taken care of and then updating the number, it would not have felt genuine to me for her to come around this quickly. I think as much as we might have wanted a big turnaround for this big, the supposedly climactic episode, having her start to have the get the information but not necessarily fully accept it or process it yet, and certainly the end of the episode with her getting that further potential nugget of doubt from the supposed terrorist, but no, based on everything she's been given and everything she's been doing for all of these many years now, it's like, yes, of course she takes him down. As far as she's concerned, he is the fourth member of the cell, and this is what she does. But I like the way they were setting it up. So she's getting the bits of information, and both from the circumstances, from Finch, and certainly from these increasingly antagonistic relationships with Samaritan and Samaritan's reps. So I think they're actually setting that up very well for her to eventually not come around to Team Machine, but be in the classic enemy of my enemy is my friend situation down the road.
Yeah, maybe my feeling about Control is due to the fact that they left it so open-ended with Shaw that I was looking for maybe, okay, well, why then couldn't they give us some better feeling of closure with Control? But that's just maybe my lack of enthusiasm for the open-ended way that they ended what was touted so much as a trilogy. Yeah. But there we are. Okay, so moving on then, we are just going to talk very briefly about the Bottom show this week, because it was actually a show that we none of us really watch. But it is interesting to note that last week, The Good Wife was in second place and almost was the best show of the week. And this week, it goes all the way down to the bottom of the list. Granted, there's a little bit less competition, but in this case, The Good Wife, Season 6, Episode 12, The Debate. Alicia and Frank Prady appear in a crucial debate in the race for a state's attorney while Peter and the city of Chicago prepare for a potential riot. Henry felt that this was perhaps a little too on the nose with recent events in the real world, not unlike some comments from last week about the elementary episode, for instance. But really, he took some exception to the fact that, that this really is a cast or show that is focused on characters of, shall we say, white privilege. And this was an episode that focused a lot on racial relations from their point of view. So he was kind of pointing out that it got a bit pretentious at times and perhaps a little preachy in some very uncomfortable ways. So it went from almost, a 9 or so down to a 6.5. So a bit of a flop from Henry's point of view. Gary, there are only a couple shows here that you also watched with us in our kind of remaining content. Which one of those do you believe deserves a little bit more in-depth discussion?
Oh, I think, there's two episodes of The Librarians, but I thought the first one definitely deserves it. It's The Librarians and The Rule of Three.
Yes, let's go ahead and run a promo for that. All right, and Gary, if you don't mind doing the recap, and you can probably do both since it was a double billing this time around.
Fair enough. We're talking about The Librarians, first season, of course, episodes 7 and 8. Episode 7 was The Librarians and the Rule of Three. A group of competitive high school students use witchcraft to undermine each other, prompting the librarians to intervene before the students destroy themselves. And also episode 8, The Librarians and the Heart of Darkness. The team embarks on a mission to destroy a haunted house.
Yes, and The Rule of Three got an average of 8.25, so a well above average episode. And then The Heart of Darkness got a 7.33, so closer to an average episode. And I would agree. Maybe not that wide of a breach, but I definitely felt that the Rule of Three was possibly the best episode of the show so far.
Oh, I agree.
You agreed, yeah.
I rated it at a 9, and I almost went much higher. As I tried to think about it, the only thing that I felt that this was lacking was a bit more development from our two male librarians. I felt like they got a little bit of the short shift as far as focus went. I thought this librarians episode not only sort of characterized all the strengths of the characters and the premise of the show, but it also really pushed the show much further. It really was the awakening episode, if you want to think of it that way. Here we have this character who we almost think is going to be the big bad. Morgan Le Fay gets introduced as the ultimate villain, and Fredericks even is intimidated by her and wants her killed, actually shot dead or somehow otherwise.
Fredericks is the one from Warehouse 13.
Anyway, Jenkins, yes. Wow, that was a slip. Jenkins, you know, is actually angry that the Guardian does not kill Morgan Le Fay, and then Morgan Le Fay says, you know, she doesn't want to rule. She wants to get out of here because, you know, this world's going to be destroyed. It's going to be horrible. She wants the heck out while she can. So here you get this person who, you know, Jenkins is so intimidated by. And, you know, wants dead at almost any cost, and yet she has no desire to become the recurring big bad villain, which is almost what I felt like they were setting her up for. But then they do a switch on us and say, no, she's trying to get power so she can get out of here. She doesn't want anything to do with the place because such bad things are coming. And you think to yourself, oh, wow, if the big bad wants out, what is coming up? What a wonderful teaser and, sort of a path forward for the show. Also, we got a little bit more background on Jenkins that he's he's been around a lot longer than anybody really knows or thought up to this point. I thought he might have been around, you know, his traditional human lifespan, but obviously they heavily implied that he's been around much longer. So who the heck is Jenkins really? That's what that'll be interesting to find out. And I mean, also we got them to introduce talk about a modern concept, the STEM concept of for education. You know, I thought that was wonderful to bring such a relatively current topic of discussion amongst that kids are used to dealing with on a daily basis now in a lot of schools into the TV show and play it up a little bit. I mean, and then to go to a science fair and even have him bring up the corny baking soda volcano and then really amp it up to the nth degree and shock the heck out of you. It just felt like not only did they have fun with it, but all the characters seemed to be really, the actors were into their characters, and it just seemed like everything was pretty much firing on all cylinders. And I wanted to hold back, like giving almost going to the 10, because I can't imagine how much better this show can get than this episode was. It was just, like I said, other than a little bit of I wish there was a few more character beats with all the characters, I thought it came out phenomenal. It did everything that, you know, they'd set out to do in the show and executed it flawlessly. I just felt they took on a nice topic. It was covered well and, you know, laid foundations and gave us discoveries of our existing characters. I just thought to myself, win, win, win. Okay. You guys weren't quite as ecstatic over it as I was, but I mean, I can't imagine how much more good they could have done in this episode.
I think it was maybe, again, just slight things of tone here and there was really the only difference, because I have to agree, if this was the template for the show going forward, I'd be just happy as could be. This recalls the best times of Warehouse 13 in my mind. I loved the shading they gave to Jenkins. I felt like John Larroquette kind of dropped the goofy side and showed a serious tone to his character that I really wasn't expecting him to go there. It explains why they brought him into that role, perhaps. The mythology that it introduced, there was really nothing about this story-wise that I had a problem with. It was just the occasional tone here and there, maybe the acting in the scene or that. It was nothing terrible, but it was clearly the best episode of the season so far. And like I said, if this is what they decided to use as the template going forward, it would be a winner. It really was taking the concept and going where I wanted them to go with it. You know, this was not the goofiness that was bothering me before. This is a more, not necessarily a more serious show, but a more cohesive and satisfying entertainment show. It's still family friendly, but it's just more satisfying. Edmund, how about you? I mean, you gave it an 8 as well.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I echo everything that's been said, and that whole thing of setting it at the science fair and sort of embracing the geeky side of the show and the characters, it was reminding me of some of the stuff Supernatural has done with their meta episodes, with the conventions and the novels and certainly the High School Musical just recently. Really embracing that concept and then running with it and having a good time with it and making it very entertaining, which I really loved. And then on top of it, as Gary said, this whole thing of bringing in Morgan Le Fay, but bringing her in as much to emphasize how horrible this potential magic apocalypse that they're facing is, it was really well done. And also the one part that nobody's mentioned yet was having our little cross casting from Arrow with Bex Taylor Klaus, who apparently doesn't have as much to do on Arrow now that Sarah is off the show. We haven't really seen her that much, but I loved her introduction and certainly her being a potential assistant librarian or adjunct librarian. I think would be another great direction for them to go. So it was a great example of introducing a new potential recurring guest star.
Is that who that was? Actually, Gary, well, if you follow up on, I guess, what were your issues with then the Heart of Darkness?
Well, I want to start off by saying that I thought it was a great attempt for them to do the horror movie and do it in the lighter tone that they do it. They couldn't get, you know, overly gore-ish with it, or even, you know, even their suspense level has to stop at a certain point, I feel. And that's the makeup of the show. That's the character of the show. So within those limitations, I thought they presented it well. It just seemed to execute poorly. And I felt like they stretched it out a little bit longer than they needed to. It seemed like the premise was a little too short, or they almost needed a B plot running, but we never quite got that. Maybe if the guys who were stuck in the dollhouse, you know, had some sort of something to deal with, that they could have gone back and forth. But the house itself with the girl, it just seemed like stretching it out, especially when they had to go outside twice and come back. It just seemed like, okay, they went outside, they got attacked, so now they got to go outside again. But we already know there's problems. Aren't they going to get assaulted? Aren't they going to get attacked again? No, take them out. The plot seemed stretched out a little bit, but at the same time, the premise and the setup was excellent. I have to say, the story writers are, you know, pulling out some really good things. And I have to wonder with Jenkins, as he sends the librarians to these different events, I think I'm getting the sense that they're not discoveries so much as trials. I have a sense that as they ask him about things, and he seems to be able to pretty much whip out every bit of information about the issue, that he knows it was happening, or at least knows what's going to happen to some extent, and that these are more tests than quests to solve something.
That would be a really interesting spin on it, wouldn't it? I didn't mind it so much. I thought that the resolution was fairly interesting, and I liked that Cassandra was getting a bit of a focus. It was really a nice way to touch on her character quirks, and it was nice for them to reference yet again the fact that, you know, she did start off by betraying them. I thought that they kind of forgot about that a little bit. It was nice to touch on that again. But
it's interesting that she didn't forget about it.
yeah, that's the part that, you know, she's dwelling on it more than they seem to be, and just the extent of her illness, too. I mean, yeah, they've talked about it, but it was a good reminder of what that means for her. And seeing things from her perspective again was a nice touch. And
for me, I don't know if it's just because we had now heard about them putting things out of order, but my biggest issue with this episode was that, to me, it obviously should have been earlier in the season. And certainly to what Gary was saying about Jenkins' attitude, that makes more sense when it's at the beginning, when he's still ticked off about all the events and not really respecting these new librarians, etc. And then certainly with Cassandra's issues, that makes more sense if it's closer to the time when she had actually betrayed them. And it was especially the fact that they ran these two episodes back to back and ran the episode where they were all operating so well together as a team first, and then go to this next episode where they're still kind of feeling each other out and haven't quite figured out how to operate, and the whole thing of them trying to, you know, trying to make them more of a military unit and clearing the rooms. And so, I mean, for me, I really had a hard time getting past that disconnect. I feel like I'm at another point in the timeline, even though this supposedly happened after this really good episode where everything was humming along. So, I have hunted around a little bit, but I haven't found exactly where in the production order or script order this was. But I was rather amused that on Rebecca Romijn's, I think it's her Tumblr feed, she has basically admitted that yes, they're being aired out of order, but it doesn't really matter as far as following the plot. And to my mind, this weekend was the prime example of, well, no, it actually does matter sometimes.
Yeah, basically my other point that I made was that this coming on the heels of the strongest episode made this a little bit harder of a sell. But if it wasn't for the fact that it was focusing on a character that I felt was, you know, needed a little bit of fleshing out, I may have not been as favorable towards it as a result.
Yeah, I think I agree that my score for the second one was definitely affected by the superiority of the first.
Yeah. Let's see here while we're on the list. Edmund, was there any other show that you wanted to cover while we were here?
I guess I can just quickly weigh in on the show that only I watched, which was Elementary, their return from the little hiatus, the Eternity Injection. Do you want to just run right into it? Do we want to run the promo?
No promo needed. I think we can just do the recap.
Sure. It's Watson and Holmes search for a missing nurse Joan used to work with. The investigation leads him to another person who recently disappeared. Meanwhile, Sherlock struggles with sobriety when he finds the recovery process monotonous. This I thought was a bit of a return to form. Certainly, largely because the Watson and Holmes relationship is coming more to the fore again, it's perhaps getting they're perhaps going to the well a little too much in terms of having these characters who are connected with Watson showing up with cases, but it does give them a decent hook for Holmes to worm his way into this one, since her friend shows up at the place where she thinks she is living, where she used to live, the case itself. As we said before, our spoiler policy applies to our viewers, but not necessarily to our co-hosts, so I will try and leave Gary somewhat in the dark.
Actually, as I wasn't sure, but as you read it, I did see this episode, actually, so when you're done, I will speak with you on it.
Okay, wonderful. But I thought it was quite a nicely twisty case, which I'm sure if John was watching with us, he would have started to fume, as it seemed to involve big pharma and nasty drug trials and things. But it did wind up being a rogue element, not the nasty corporation that seemed to be rearing its head.
Don't worry, Helix will, I'm sure, poke that bear soon enough.
Absolutely. Certainly the hook they were using for with Sherlock having continuing his new struggles with going to meetings, and just as he says, the sheer monotony of leading a sober life, just the fact they were using that as the hook for Joan as his former sober companion, and obviously the person who he can most easily share those concerns with, other than his sponsor, but the fact that they were we're bringing the two of them back together and actually we're working on this this newer, more mature relationship. I really enjoy it. So, you know, sort of it's, you know, it becomes sort of the typical template for an elementary episode. You've got the case and then you've got the personal side. But I thought both worked pretty well, or at least better than it has recently in this one.
Yeah, no, I agree. Number one, I want to start off with the premise of this. The title of the show episode was The Eternity Injection, and you'd almost think that, oh, it's going to be like to prolong life or something along those lines. But the twist on it was that it just changes your perception of time, so that even though a minute passes, it feels for you like an hour or a day has passed, because it just sort of accelerates the neurons or the connections in your brain to make your perceived time go faster. And so I thought that was a really cool little gimmick or thing to present. So that already had me sort of caught me off guard with this episode, to do something I would consider untraditional. Someone else Joan knows gets hurt, and it's a trope that they are playing off too often. Poor Joan, she's not gonna have anybody left in another two seasons. They did a bit of somewhat traditional detective work, and it was, for me, I felt it was pretty much by the book, but it worked out well. It got them to the person who was doing these illegal drug trials, and then they assume that it's a large company sponsoring him, and in the end, it turns out to not be. It turns out to be just a rich individual that sponsored this scientist as he was going through his educational career, and there was some not quite a quid pro quo, because I don't think this was all set up, just that the scientist owed this rich person a debt for his years of sponsoring him and his education. So, I mean, it's just sort of made a traditional thing and explained why a scientist would do something that was so out of bounds and really unethical, because of this strong connection he had growing up with the other man. So it worked out. I worked out well in that sense. And the scenes that Edmund was speaking about with Sherlock and Joan were very touching, as he sort of explains how it's just so staggeringly monotonous to, you know, to do it right every day, where, you know, you could have it, you know, if you went off, you wouldn't have to, you know, to go through this routine. Of course, you know, you'd have to get back there again anyway, so what's the point in going off the road if you have to come back in the first place? Also, Joan reached out and almost wanted to almost reset the relationship to some extent, and, you know, ask, you know, do you want me to stay here? Do you need like more help? And, you know, thankfully Sherlock has indeed grown, and, you know, he said he didn't need her there. At one time he might have insisted that she be present, or, you know, yeah, I need more help. But I guess maybe he actually is strong enough that he's able to resist these temptations, even though it can be challenging at times. And I don't know if it's the temptations themselves that are the challenge, or just the boring monotony of not being drunk or hungover or high that is the challenge, just because it's not something different in and of itself, not the actual, you know, drug going into his veins or anything like that. So once again, it was handled well, and at the same time, it never really became a reset. I felt like as they were doing that, it was fresh ground. It wasn't something that had been done before. It was definitely a growth in their relationship. And as I said, these shows are getting better because they are bringing Joan back in, not as a extra or a cameo, but because she they integrate her into the plot, and not just because her friend died, but just because she is there and working through everything with them, and it's what you expect from the show.
Yeah, and I guess that this got an 8 collectively.
Yes.
Two of them. To kind of round out the rest, also getting an 8 was Agent Carter, season 1, episode 3, Time and Tide. Jarvis is arrested. Meanwhile, a secret is revealed. Great, the promo writers for AMC have hit ABC, apparently. Yeah, we gave this collectively an 8, but at least for my mind, this felt like a little bit of a step backward. Not in a huge way, but just not quite on the same level as the premiere. Definitely more focused on Jarvis. And what did you guys think? Any brief thoughts about this, Edmund?
For, for me, I mean, the main reason I gave it a tick up was sort of them to a certain extent kind of dialing back on the sexism aspect and her coworkers actually getting a little more well rounded and that whole element of her having to go off in these investigations and as opposed to the previous episode where she was five steps ahead of them, she was a couple of steps ahead and certainly them up in the ante with taking out the most boorish of the of her office mates, which did wind up injecting naturally a huge dose of realism both into the situation and then into the rest of the office in terms of the reactions to that. So that was where I felt the one thing that I felt that I was most concerned with from those opening two episodes, they really kind of addressed, and I thought put them in a great position to move forward from here.
Gary, how about you?
I like this episode. Again, I can definitely see where Edmund's coming from with his points. I enjoyed with the with Jarvis that while we're getting used to him playing the straight man, so to speak, and he'll do comments like when they mentioned the death ray stolen, and then he says, no, it's accounted for. It's in Nevada. You're used to these little quips and him being very straight laced. But at the same time, I love the fact that he is human, and they showed him as such when he sort of started to break down and snap during the interrogation, that he was able to get flustered, and he's as human as everyone else. So I thought that was a great feature of this episode. And generally, I enjoy that Peggy's still being played very competently. So
yeah, that's true, definitely.
So I can't say it, they covered necessarily a lot of new ground in this episode, but it was sort of, I felt like it was a fleshing out episode.
Yes, just give me one. And I guess just to round everything out, we had an episode of Resurrection, Season 2, Episode 11, True Believer. Things turn more ominous in Arcadia with the return of Preacher James, who seems to have a strange and unnerving connection to Bellamy. Elsewhere, Margaret's presence is quickly felt at the government facility, where she and other returned are being detained, and faith becomes harder to hold on to when the unthinkable happens to Henry. And I wound up giving that a 7.5. And that is it for the content this week.
Warming up the DVR and getting it ready to beat the heck out of it as it records everything.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to go ahead and close it out there then, and talk to you next week.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.